The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs. Will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
In the first month of Trump's mess, he put forth a call. We're gonna need to build a border wall. In the second month of Trump's mess, he shaped a safety plan. Enforce a Muslim ban, and he still wants to build a border wall. In the third month of Trump's mess, into corporate hands. Sell our public lands, enforce a Muslim ban, and he still wants to build a border wall. In the fourth month of Trump's mess, he threatened with the plum. Use a nuclear bomb, sell our public lands, enforce a Muslim ban, and he still wants to build a border wall. In the fifth month of Trump's mess, time to take a break. Five days of golf. Use a nuclear bomb, sell up public lands, enforce a Muslim ban, and he still wants to build a border wall. In the sixth month of Trump's mess, he gave us quite a scare. Repeal Obamacare. 5 days of golf. Use a nuclear bomb, sell up public lands, enforce a Muslim ban, and he still wants to build a border wall. In the seventh month of Trump's mess, he took a wicked stand. A transgender ban, repeal Obamacare, 5 days of golf. Use a nuclear bomb, sell up public lands, enforce a Muslim ban, and he still wants to build a border wall. In the eighth month of Trump's mess, he had a part to play. Erase the EPA, a transgender ban, repeal Obamacare, 5 days of golf. Use a nuclear bomb, sell up public lands, enforce a Muslim ban, and he still wants to build a border wall. In the ninth month of Trump's mess, he stated an ideal. Not allowed to kneel, erase the EPA, a transgender ban, repeal Obamacare, 5 days of golf. Use a nuclear bomb, sell up public lands, enforce a Muslim ban, and he still wants to build a border wall. In the 10th month of Trump's mess, he got his feelings hurt. Abolish the press, you're not allowed to kneel. Erase the EPA, a transgender ban, repeal Obamacare, 5 days of golf. Use a nuclear bomb, sell up public lands, enforce a Muslim ban, and he still wants to build a border wall. The 11th month of Trump's mess was more than I could take. The wealthy get a break, abolish the press, you're not allowed to kneel. Erase the EPA, a transgender ban, repeal Obamacare, 5 days of golf. Use a nuclear bomb, sell up public lands, enforce a Muslim ban, and he still wants to build a border wall. In the 12th month of Trump's mess, in case you hadn't heard, Christmas is a word, the wealthy get a break, abolish the press, you're not allowed to kneel, erase the EPA, a transgender ban, repeal Obamacare, 5 days of golf. Use a nuclear bomb, sell up public lands, enforce a Muslim ban, and he still wants to build a border wall.
All right. Welcome to a Wednesday. Today's Wednesday. That is about the extent of the Christmas music you'll hear on this program. By the way, the talented people singing the 12 months of Trump's mess were the Parody Project. They're online at parodyproject.com. I happened across that video, and they've got tons of them. Very talented people. Parody Project with a timely take on the 12 days of Christmas. So we get started on a Wednesday. We have a busy show for you today. Coming up a little later on, we're going to cross the pond and talk to our pal Dennis Campbell, because apparently there's a Brexit deal. Oh, yes, they did leave out that Mexico was supposed to be paying for that bloody wall. But, you know, Trump seems to have forgotten about that, too. And as have his followers. So I don't know what to tell you there. So anyway, Dennis Campbell will be along. And in a few minutes, we'll hear from David Dayan, who I think is one of the best journalists working today. He's sort of a freelancer. So he pops up everywhere from The Nation to The Intercept, to In These Times, The New Republic, and on and on. Right now, actually, he has a piece up at The Intercept that I wanted to talk to him about, because it has to do with what's going on right now in the House of Representatives, where the Democrats are voting to nominate the candidates for their leadership roles. Now, it's sort of a big, no climax there. We know what it is, apart from a lot of centrist or conservadems, as I call them, trying to challenge Nancy Pelosi from the right, and it's not going anywhere. It's basically the same old in leadership positions, except for the number four spot. Actually, I'll give you all this now because it's an update on the news. I actually recorded with David Dayan earlier this morning because he's guest hosting a radio show in Los Angeles this afternoon. We'll tell you all about it, where you can listen if you like. After I spoke with him to record the interview this morning, the House Democrats have been voting on the leadership positions. And well, sadly, to my view, Congressman Hakeem Jeffries has been elected Democratic caucus chair, beating out Barbara Lee. And now there are some, Jackie Speier and Barbara Lee are both saying Barbara Lee had the votes. And for some reason, some people flipped at the last minute. And Jackie Speier is calling for these votes in the future to be done out in the open, because people pledged their vote to Barbara Lee and, and then I guess in the end didn't vote for her. It was a 123-113 vote. So it was close. Speier, particularly, is alleging ageism and sexism. Hakeem Jeffries is only 48, and as such, that makes him the youngest member of the progressive of the Democratic leadership. Now, he's taken over the slot that Joe Crowley used to inhabit. Democratic caucus chair. Joe Crowley, of course, was beaten in the primary by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but Joe Crowley was widely expected to be the next Speaker of the House. From that caucus chair position, he was going to rise into the Speaker position. So now I guess they're saying that is a possible trajectory for Hakeem Jeffries. I'm not convinced. He's going to have to do a lot of work to get me to believe that. I know he's a member of the Progressive Caucus. I just don't know how progressive he is. I guess that's the test. We'll check in with Howie Klein tomorrow about it. But anyway, so the leadership elections are going on in the House as we speak. But we'll talk about the jockeying for position on the various committees that's going on inside the Democratic caucus. And for this, I do recommend you to the article that David Dayan has up at The Intercept. It's what we talk about in the interview. You'll hear in just a couple of minutes. And I will link to it from my blog at NicoleSandler.com after the show. All right? Okay, well, I guess the first thing we'll do is we'll talk to David Dayan, because this is what we talk about, is what's going on right now. So with no further ado, I guess it would help if I queued up the interview. I've got it here. I'm sort of discombobulated today. All right. I guess this is where I say take it away, Nicole. David Dayen is an independent journalist who contributes to The Intercept, The Nation, The New Republic, In These Times, and others. His first book, Chain of Title, about some humans who took on Wall Street's foreclosure fraud, was released in May of 2016 and is actually a must-read that should be made into a movie. Later today, David will be guest hosting Background Briefing on KPFK in Los Angeles. You can listen at 5 p.m. Pacific time at kpfk.org. Is this your first time guest hosting a big radio show?
It is. I don't want to horn in on your turf, Nicole, but I was asked, and we're going to have a good show.
Good. I'm sure you are. We'll have to tune in and listen. You've got a big story up at The Intercept about the political wrangling going on in the Democratic House caucus over committee assignments. And I guess it's good timing that we talk today, because this morning, House Democrats are voting on their leadership, with the big floor vote for Speaker coming when the new Congress gets underway in January. But do you think we're going to see any surprises, or it's going to be same old, same old?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about, to me at least, about where the House is going to be at, is that this sort of unsettled race for Speaker, and the fact that just by the rules of the House, Nancy Pelosi needs virtually every member of the Democratic caucus to vote for her in order to win, that sort of empowers members to ask for something.
Mm-hmm.
And the Progressive Caucus has done so. And they've gotten a commitment from Pelosi to get proportional representation. So the Progressive Caucus is about 40% of the entire House Democratic Caucus.
Mm-hmm.
And they want what they call proportional representation on five main committees, the Intelligence Committee, and then also what they call the money committees.
Mm-hmm.
These are the key domestic policy committees that virtually all critical legislation runs through. And that's Ways and Means, which deals with tax policy, Energy and Commerce, which deals with energy, and also health care and a number of other things. Appropriations, which is, you know, kind of any spending program gets appropriated through that committee. And financial services, which deals with bank regulation and housing policy.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, the Progressive Caucus does not have representation on those committees anywhere close to their numbers.
Right. Well, you point out that the Progressive Caucus members don't want those committees, which I find very weird. But what are they, boring?
Well, it's really interesting. So there are two things going on. First of all, you have existing members, and then you have the incoming members.
Mm-hmm.
So for existing members, they're on the committees they're on, and the House runs on seniority. And if they're sitting on their science committee or transportation committee or wherever they are, armed services, judiciary, and they have already spent a number of years there, it's a sacrifice to say to them, move committees, go back to the back of the line. It's a more important committee, but you personally will have less influence and power and less ability to move up the ladder and become a subcommittee chairman or a committee chairman at any point. So that's legitimate, right? It is an actual sacrifice. Then there are things like regional diversity. There are personality conflicts. There's the need to sort of be guided into a new committee by somebody who's already on the committee. There are a whole host of politics. You'll be surprised that politics plays a role in these political discussions.
You know, the point you made about the veteran members not wanting to have to, you know, take steps backwards in terms of seniority by getting on a new committee. That's a valid point. So why weren't
that doesn't work for the incoming members,
right? Because they don't have seniority at all.
Why are they not stepping up? Well, you know, there was good news today, a letter from the incoming freshman asking for assignments on those committees.
So that's
very good news. And maybe we've turned this thing around. But at the time I was reporting it, it was thought that the new Democrats, the centrist Democrats, mm-hmm. were much more aggressive about getting onto these money committees particularly because they often mean campaign donations. I mean, these are the committees that industry pays attention to, and you can make a lot of campaign money if you're in these positions of relative power. So, you know, the way it was put to me by someone in the article is that progressives come to Congress to change the world, and new Democrats come to Congress to get on the Ways and Means Committee.
Huh.
They are very targeted. They know what they want, and that's what they go for. Progressives, you know, they come out of whether they were attorneys. They flock to the Judiciary Committee. The Judiciary Committee has about 3/4 of it members of the Progressive Caucus.
Wow.
So there seem to be almost cliques where your committee work is a lot of what you do in Congress, and you want to be with people of like mind so you can get things done. It's just easier. So there has been sort of a segregation where the new Dems move to these money committees and the progressives move more in proportion to places like Judiciary. So what we're seeing now is sort of a new awareness on the part of outside groups, labor unions, that if progressives are not on these committees, the overall output of Congress shifts, particularly on domestic policy and these key issues around, you know, things that are broadly extremely important, whether you're talking about climate and the environment or healthcare or federal spending, tax policy. I mean, these things are monumentally important. Yeah.
So it's obviously important. And so now the committee, I know Nancy Pelosi has been sort of wheeling and dealing with some. Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, I guess, got some concessions where she's going to be named to a new committee. I can't even remember what her issue was, but it was, I want to say, having to do with guns, but I could be totally off base.
I think you're right there. And you know, I mean, that's something that's extremely important to her and was important to her, you know, coming into Congress. But it's not a money committee, right? The question is, can the Progressive Caucus, having, you know, secured this promise from Nancy Pelosi, find the numbers to reach that proportional representation on these very important committees? And that's sort of the internal struggle that's going on right now as we speak.
Right. We're speaking with David Dayan, who's got a great piece up at The Intercept. It was a big piece right before Thanksgiving to give those of us who, I guess, you know, didn't have too much turkey to eat, something to read. And it is fascinating reading about the jockeying now going on for committee assignments in the now democratically controlled House. The Congressional Progressive Caucus is under new leadership, basically. It was Raul Grijalva and Keith Ellison, and then Ellison left to become vice chair of the DNC, and Mark Pocan came in and took his place. And now Pramila Jayapal will be replacing Raul Grijalva. It seems like maybe it's a more, aggressive leadership team in the Progressive Caucus. I've always been surprised at how little clout the CPC has, given that it's the largest caucus in the House of Representatives, aside from the two parties.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think Pocan and Jayapal have come in and really tightened the focus of the Progressive Caucus. Progressive Caucus used to be sort of a badge that members could wear. Like, hey, I'm a progressive, I'm in the Progressive Caucus. But did it mean anything, right? Did it mean that members would vote a certain way?
Nope.
I mean, there are members who are simultaneously in the Progressive Caucus and the New Democrat Caucus.
Yeah, I think Beto O'Rourke is one of them.
It's completely at odds. I mean, there's no reason. I don't think Beto O'Rourke is actually in the Progressive Caucus.
No.
But there are several who are in both, which makes no sense at all. There just hasn't been a lot of meaning attached to being in the Progressive Caucus.
Right.
What does it actually mean? And I think you're going to see that tighten up in this new Congress. You might see fewer members actually of the Progressive Caucus, because people members are basically told, like, you have to, you know, at least show some obvious steps in which you are actually progressive in your voting record and, mm-hmm. and your advocacy. So, but that would, you know, a smaller, more focused caucus would be more effective.
I guess one thing that they do every year is the Progressive Caucus puts out what they call the People's Budget, an alternative budget, which always is great. I mean, there's so much good stuff there, and it gets ignored from one end of the media to the other. I mean, I think shows like mine are the only place you even hear about the People's Budget that the Progressive Caucus puts out every year. So hopefully, you know, they'll get taken a little more seriously.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, this is an encouraging step, what the leaders, the co-chairs have done to go in and demand representation on these committees. It shows that they're thinking very strategically about how progressives can band together and use their power. And so that's definitely very positive. Now, if you make that promise, you have to back it up. You have to have the horses. We're seeing, you know, some incoming members, as I said, looking to these committees as important. Rashida Tlaib, who's mm-hmm. Out in Detroit in that district that John Conyers used to run, be the representative for. She wants to be on the Appropriations Committee.
Good.
In recent days, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has said she wants to be part of the Energy and Commerce Committee. So we are seeing these incoming members also with a more strategic sense of where they can best be used and how they can best make an immediate impact. And I think that's helping the co-chairs of the caucus as well, because they have a very, a powerful incoming freshman class that has the ear of the country that they can use to their advantage.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your piece at The Intercept, you proclaim that Nancy Pelosi is going to be speaker again. There's not a whole lot of suspense there. That's what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And although that seemed to be up for discussion and there were some challenges along the way, what was never challenged were the next two positions, Steny Hoyer and Jim Clyburn, as House Majority Leader and House Majority Whip. I guess they're a team, but I would think those two positions I'm surprised they weren't challenged.
Right. So, you know, I mean, all of these top three are in their late 70s and have been the leadership team for the last 15 years.
Wow.
In among House Democrats. What's interesting is what we're seeing at the number four position.
Yep.
Now, that used to be held by Joe Crowley, who was beaten by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yep.
But today there's going to be an election between Barbara Lee, the iconic member from the Oakland area, who would be the first African-American woman in House leadership, period,
mm-hmm.
And Hakeem Jeffries, who is seen, also a member of the Progressive Caucus, seen as a slightly more moderate, but would be, you know, is in his second term, and is, you know, in his 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So that would break that cycle of, this older, you know, leadership that's been around for a long time. Either way, it's going to be, paradigm shifting a little bit. And I hasten to say I'll be talking about that on my radio show.
Oh, great.
later today.
Very cool. Yeah, one of the suggestions I made, not that anyone was listening to me, was that if it's got to be Pelosi, Hoyer, and Clyburn in the 1, 2, and 3 positions, each one of them should be required to take on a younger member, either a freshman or, you know, someone who is coming up in the ranks, to shadow them, to be sort of, you know, an intern, if you will, on the leadership team. So at least there's a path to leadership instead of this closed off club, and we get some new blood in there. And I heard something along the lines of...
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And in recent years, Pelosi has made a few more leadership spots available to bring in younger members and give them an opportunity. But there's a lot of frustration in the caucus, and a lot of this anti-Pelosi sentiment is because of that. Because of there hasn't been a path for younger members to rise through the ranks. What we know now is that the current anti-Pelosi movement is really just, you know, conservative Democrats who have ideological designs. It's pretty clear when you see the Problem Solvers Caucus, yep, and things like that, that's what's driving this now. But there is a broader sort of discontent with change in leadership. I think that ultimately what's going to happen is going to be similar to what happened in after the class of 74, the Watergate babies,
right,
which was another huge freshman class. The speaker at that time was a guy named Carl Albert. He was reelected for the speakership in 1975, and he lasted one term.
Hmm.
And then it changed to Tip O'Neill.
Wow.
And a lot of that was because he had problems with the very fractious freshman class coming in who had different priorities. I think that this, I do not see Nancy Pelosi lasting as speaker more than one or two terms.
Right.
You know, some of it's going to depend on the 2020 election. But my feeling is that she's sort of a placeholder, and we're going to see new leadership eventually in the House.
Well, it's got to be, because the three of them are going to die off.
It could be out of for natural causes, but I do think there'll be some political causes as well.
I hear you. Before I let you go, Dave, one other question. On the Senate, obviously there's not going to be as much jockeying around as there's no leadership change in the Senate.
And that's the problem.
Yes, it is the problem. And why nobody questioned Chuck Schumer as the
right,
minority leader in the Senate when they went after Pelosi, I don't understand, but that's a,
right,
a topic for another day.
Might be the gender of those two
leaders. That could have something to do with it. But the disconcerting thing I heard is that because the Democrats lost two Senate seats, that could change up the composition of some of the committees. And because she's the most junior senator on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Kamala Harris might lose her seat on that Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, it's likely. I mean, it's just a numbers game.
Yeah.
So when you change from 51-49 to 53-47, mm-hmm, and you have sort of a proportionality on these committees, it changes, you know, who gets to stay on them. And, you know, you combine that with the loss of members like Heidi Heitkamp and, mm-hmm, Joe Donnelly, yeah, and Claire McCaskill. There's going to be some shuffling there with respect to the committee assignments. Now, you know, I mean, Kamala Harris, for her, that was sort of a stage she's certainly going to have another stage possibly or probably in 2019 and 2020 by running for president. So I'm not sure, you know, what the policy impact of that is necessarily, especially with Republicans still running the House, but you know, and it being unsettled where you know Kamala Harris is going to land and going to be in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, I mean, it's something to pay attention to. I'm looking at the Banking Committee actually in the Senate, and you know, they're Donnelly and Heitkamp were on that committee.
Oh, wow.
They're dropping off.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to get back on that committee? We saw sort of an internal coup almost of conservative Democrats in the Senate on that committee writing a bill with Republican Mike Crapo that deregulated the banking industry, and it's because they were, you know, part of that committee. So hopefully, you know, two of those people lost.
Yep.
And so maybe we'll see a better composition there in the Banking Committee.
Yeah, let's hope so. Actually, Kamala Harris would be great there. So, you know,
yeah, there you go.
To put some regulations back in place. David Dane, thank you so much. This is a great piece up at The Intercept. I will link to it from my blog today at NicoleSandler.com, along with to the podcast of today's show. And a reminder, again, you can check out David on guest hosting for, is it Ian Masters you're filling in for?
That's right, yeah.
On
for Ian.
On KPFK and all their stations, kpfk.org, it's 5 p.m. Pacific. And you can always read, Dave, tell people how they can sign up for your mailing list, because you send out an email that's great.
Yeah, I do a newsletter twice a week. It's at tinyletter.com/David Dayen. That's David, D-A-Y-E-N. And I put in there links to all the stories that I've written during the week and a little extra added content.
Definitely. You share the wealth. I always appreciate your newsletter. So thank you for that and the work you do. David Dane, I appreciate you coming on with us today and have fun this afternoon.
All right. Thanks a lot. Okay. I'll learn from your example.
You got it. All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
David Dane, he's really, first of all, he's so prolific. I mean, there are days that he has like three stories up at three different outlets, and he knows his shit. He's really one of the good ones. So again, I'll have the link to his story up at The Intercept, or you can just go to TheIntercept.com and search for David Dane. It's his latest piece there. It's about the wrangling inside the Democratic caucus, which will soon be under Democratic control. All right, in a few minutes, we're going to check in with our buddy Dennis Campbell across the pond in Great Britain, find out what's happening with Brexit and all that stuff. But I do have the latest news. Again, a quick update on what we were talking about, David Dane and I, and what I go into a little bit of detail in what's news about is the elections in the Democratic caucus to nominate the members for leadership positions that will be voted on once Congress reconvenes for the 116th session in January. But Hakeem Jeffries beat out Barbara Lee in a 123-113 vote to become the new Democratic caucus chair, taking the seat that was lost by Joe Crowley when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez beat him. So there's that. All right, stick around. Dennis Campbell on the way, but first a look at the news here at NicoleSandler.com and on the Progressive Voices Network.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
As pundits warn that the Mueller probe could be close to wrapping up, something Mueller's office has never commented on and might be totally untrue, we're seeing some movement. The New York Times reporting that one of Paul Manafort's lawyers regularly briefed Trump's legal team about Manafort's conversations with federal investigators as part of Mueller's probe into the Russian meddling in the 2016 elections, even after Manafort and Mueller's people reached a plea deal.
The reporters write that Manafort's lawyer, quote, repeatedly briefed President Trump's lawyers on his client's discussions with federal investigators about Mr. Manafort after Mr. Manafort agreed to cooperate with the special counsel, according to one of Mr. Trump's lawyers and two other people familiar with the conversations. The arrangement was highly unusual and inflamed tensions with Mr. Mueller's office when prosecutors discovered it after Mr. Manafort began cooperating 2 months ago, the people said. Some legal experts speculated that it was a bid by Mr. Manafort for a presidential pardon, even as he worked with the special counsel, Robert Mueller, in hopes of a lighter sentence.
Well, Manafort's plea deal with Robert Mueller blew up after he repeatedly lied to investigators, an allegation that Manafort denies. Both sides asked the judge to move forward on sentencing immediately. That wasn't the only breaking news story on Monday. Brian Williams of MSNBC also told about some draft emails from Jerome Corsi to Roger Stone, warning Stone that two more WikiLeaks document dumps would be coming in October.
Mueller's team has obtained email communications from August of 2016 between the conservative author and conspiracy theorist Jerome Corsi and Trump advisor and longtime friend Roger Stone, the WikiLeaks release of emails stolen from the Clinton campaign. These Corsi Stone emails showed up in a draft court filing sent from Mueller's team to Jerome Corsi's lawyer. NBC News reports that according to court papers, Corsi told investigators that an associate identified by Corsi as Roger Stone asked him in the summer of 2016 to get in touch with an organization identified by Corsi as WikiLeaks about unreleased materials relevant to the presidential campaign. NBC says Corsi told Mueller that he declined the request, but Mueller's team says that wasn't true. The court document says Corsi passed on the request to someone in London and then eventually did email Stone in August saying WikiLeaks had damaging information on Clinton and it would release it in October of 2016.
The Guardian published a bombshell story on Tuesday alleging that Manafort had multiple meetings with Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy where he's been holed up for years. The meetings are alleged to have taken place dating back to 2013 and includes one in March of 2016, just as Manafort became Trump's campaign chair. Donald Trump sat for two print interviews on Tuesday with the Washington Post and Politico. The Post's Philip Rucker was one of the reporters asking the questions.
He was his normal self. He's charming and charismatic and wants you to like him. He offered us drinks. He had no notes in front of him. The desk was pretty clear. He did have aides, though, both Sarah Sanders and Bill Shine, as well as Kellyanne Conway, counselor to the president, sat alongside us next to the Oval Office. And the president, in one area, was particularly unusually disciplined. When we asked him about the latest developments in the Mueller probe, the Russia investigation, and the news about Paul Manafort, he refused to talk about that on the record. He said, look, I'm not going to get in the middle of that situation. He talked to us at length about it off the record and shared his views. But when we pressed him if we could share any of those comments with the public on the record, he said no. And that seemed to be him following direction from his staff.
To the Post, Trump placed responsibility for recent stock market declines and this week's announcement of General Motors cutbacks on the Federal Reserve. During this bizarre interview with the Washington Post, he declared that he is, quote, not even a little bit happy with Jerome Powell, the man he installed as chairman of the Federal Reserve. In the same interview, when asked about the report on climate change, Trump dismissed the National Climate Assessment. He actually said this, quote, one of the problems that a lot of people like myself, we have very high levels of intelligence, but we're not necessarily such believers as to whether or not it's man-made and whether or not the effects that you're talking about are there. I don't see it. The 2018 midterm elections are slowly winding down. On Tuesday, New Mexico certified the results of the congressional race, giving Democrats yet another victory as Sochi Torres Small, the Democrat, officially defeats Republican Yvette Herrell. This brings the number of Democratic gains in the House to 39 seats, with one race still outstanding. In Mississippi, Republican Cindy Hyde-Smith defeated her Democratic challenger, Mike Espy, in the Senate runoff election. Although news organizations are hailing that race as the end of the 2018 midterm elections, there's actually still one more important race to go. Georgia will go to the polls again on Tuesday, December 4th, for the runoff election for Secretary of State between Republican Brad Raffensperger and Democrat John Barrow. The outgoing Secretary of State, now Governor-elect Brian Kemp, is accused of suppressing the vote of minorities in this year's elections. And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener funded, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate.
Can't afford a monthly donation? Is that what's getting you down, Bunky? But maybe you shop on Amazon.com occasionally?
Well then, just use the NicoleSandler.com Amazon portal and we'll get a small commission on all your purchases.
But I just bought...
Don't worry, we can't see what you bought.
Just bookmark Amazon through the NicoleSandler.com portal and use it. Every purchase helps Nicole stay on the air.
Just one more quick note before we move on across the pond to speak with Dennis Campbell. I want to thank listeners Lois and JJ who have issued our next matching donation. They have offered to match up to $500 in donations. So any donation you give to the show, a contribution to our cause between now and the end of the year, up to $500, they will match. And I can't thank them enough for that. And you, too, for helping to pitch in. All right. Dennis Campbell, you know him. He is the publisher of UK Progressive Magazine, which you can access at ukprogressive.co.uk. And he's one of the hosts of the Three Muckrakers podcast. Hello, Dennis Campbell. How are you doing today?
I'm very fine, Nicole Sandler. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. So how are things over there? I hear you're having a big windstorm or something.
Well, for us, it's normal. But for most people, you'd consider 40, 50 knot winds to be, quite bad. But here in Wales, we're tough. We can handle it.
Well, it's like the Santa Ana winds out in California. Unfortunately, those lots of wildfires.
Without the same calamity that comes with those Santa Anas.
No
I've
kidding.
Lived there, so I understand.
Yeah. So there's news coming from your shores. Where news of a Brexit deal? Have they come to some agreement?
Well, yes. Last week, they came up with a draft agreement, the UK and Brussels. Now, keep in mind, it's not just the UK, but there are 27 other countries that have to sign off on this deal. So it was not a given by any stretch of the imagination. They signed, they have a draft agreement now, which comes back here to the UK this coming week, not this week, but next week, during which they're going to debate in Parliament and have a vote, hopefully, they think, by the 11th of December. Now, keep in mind that the 11th of December, we're 3 months away from the Brexit deadline. And we are in a situation where this draft 585-page document has three key sticking points. Number one, we've got to stay in the customs union, particularly in Northern Ireland, because of the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. You know, the rest of the country is not a problem because it's an island, but between Northern Ireland and the Republic, you can't re-erect a border and customs crossings. It's just going to be next to impossible because in some instances, the the border runs right down the middle of a street and through homes and through property. Wow. So, this is going to be interesting. So they're going to stay, according to this document, in the customs union indefinitely. We've got another problem with the London Financial Union, because under this draft agreement, that anything that's established in the United Kingdom is going to be treated as an entity located outside the European Union. So basically, if you're doing transactions in London, it's going to be treated as if you're doing transactions in New York if you're a member of the 27, which is going to create tremendous problems for the movement and flow of money. And freedom of movement, that's going to be maintained until the final agreement is reached, and EU citizens and UK nationals in their host states during the transition period are going to enjoy the same rights as those who arrived in the host state before the 30th of March, 2019. So those are the three main sticking points. And members of the cabinet did not like that. They had a meeting when she came back from Brussels and the cabinet met. And as they always do, they had a lot of huzzas and hurrahs and yes, yes, yes. And they said, yes, we're going to accept it. And then literally the next morning, from 7:20 a.m. until 3 p.m., seven members of the cabinet resigned.
Wow.
This is shades of July when President Trump was coming for a visit. They had come up with a Brexit deal, and the whole Brexit team resigned. Uh-huh. And the most interesting resignation is that of Dominic Raab, who was the Brexit secretary, who negotiated the deal, who says the deal is now unworkable.
Oh, my. Not exactly a vote of confidence there. Let me back up a second here because, all right, so the British subjects voted for this Brexit deal, but did I also read that more recently there was a poll taken where a majority of people over there would like a new referendum on Brexit?
Yeah, I think part of the problem was during that election, which, of course, had Russian interference
in
Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah. And that's,
That's where it all started, of course,
right? So,
because that was several months, that was back in June of 2016, several months before your election in November.
Yep.
And literally the lies that were permeated by both groups were just abhorrent, and people just hardened and, you know, voted. And they basically cast a protest vote, much the same as people there did for Donald Trump, and basically said, oh, the hell with it. Let's get out and we'll make our own way and go forward from there. That was the way most Brexiteers did. But they were sold a whole bill of goods. They were told, well, you know, the £350 million a week, which is about $500 million that we send off to Europe, will be used to help then shore up the NHS.
Right.
Well, that was a lie within the first 10 minutes of the election.
And that's huge. And that's one they, I mean, a lot I heard about that one over here. While they're going to put all that money into the National Health Service, that can only be a good thing. And they admitted, like, the day after the election that it was a lie.
Yeah. And the National Health Service has got massive problems. There's about a 30,000 person shortfall in terms of doctors and nurses because for the last 2.5 years, people from Europe and other parts of the world have been told, you're not welcome here. So basically all the medical professionals that have been coming here to, you know, take care of the British people are not coming anymore. And we're into winter now, and winter is a notoriously bad time for the NHS because the need rises with the colder weather, and they're not going to have enough nurses and doctors to take care of people.
Now, let me ask you this. Dennis Campbell is with us from the UK. And I know we know that the National Health Service, the way it works is you get sick, you go to the doctor. You don't get a bill. It's paid for out of your taxes. So instead of paying a health insurance premium every month, it's included in the taxes you pay. So maybe your taxes are a little higher, but you don't have a health insurance nut to pay each month. But you mentioned you off the air, you took your daughter to go check out a university. Is public education through university free over there? How does it work?
The tuition is free, but they've managed to come up with a series of what are called, I can't even think of what the word is, but it is in some respects a tax. It's in some respects a loan, and they can run up to £7,000 a year, which is about $10,000,
wow,
much less than the cost of a university education.
True.
And of course, they can also take out study fees for living expenses, so to pay for their board,
right,
and food and books and expenses. So all told, my son is in his first year at Swansea University, where he's studying physics. He has a loan, but that loan will be forgiven unless he comes out and starts to earn immediately £21,000 a year,
wow,
which is about $25,000. And over time, it's not designed to be something that hangs over their head. So that's the big difference between our system and the system there, where no matter what happens, your loan is still there, still, clocking up interest and fees.
No matter what. So. There are people who are, dying of old age who are still paying off student loans. It's insane.
Yeah.
But so that's basically the same as what the progressives are advocating for over here. Free tuition at public colleges and universities. So, you don't pay for the classes, for the credit hours, but you still have to pay for room and board and textbooks and the incidentals that go along with it. So that makes sense. So is there any program for medical students to, get a free medical education in return for working for so many years for the NHS?
Yeah, they do. They have a system whereby they're education, of course, is 7 or 8 years in length, and of course they have residency and other things that go on. But a lot of those fees can be exchanged if you choose to work in economically distressed areas or within the NHS in areas where they're having great difficulties finding, people to fill those roles. But even that is not enough, because most people want to come and live here. And if there's this uncertainty, which is what we've had forever with Brexit, they're not going to want to, find themselves in a situation where they come, they invest all this energy, and then they go home with a lot of debt, and they're still not sure where they're going to teach. So they're going to Australia, they're going to Canada, they're going to the United States, any place other than here. And this has been a direct byproduct of all this Brexit uncertainty.
Right. I don't know why they would come here, though, because it's going to cost them much more than pretty much anywhere else in the world that they'd choose to go to school.
Yeah. And we do, when students come from other countries into this country, because we had a lot of Chinese students and others, there is a higher fee structure. They also pay tuition.
Uh-huh.
So,
sure,
for most universities, it's a cash cow for them to, because they don't earn enough off of the students here in the UK. So it's a tough situation.
Well, to get back to the Brexit vote that, you brought up Cambridge Analytica and all that, how much do you think it was a legitimate vote, and how much do you think it was sort of pushed in that direction by some outside players?
Well, we have tremendous turnout here, and almost 80% showed up. So that's first and foremost. So I think that's, you have to respect, even though it was 51.7 to, 48.2 or whatever it is, it was less than 2 points. It still, was a decision. We didn't like the decision. But what's happening now is that people are saying, look, because of everything that's come up, we've really got to find a way to, get the benefit of the doubt with this. And there's a huge call for a second referendum. And the Liberal Democrats, the party that I was associated with a couple of years ago, they've been leading the charge on that, leading the charge on staying in Europe, because it's so much easier. Right now, everything is going to be ripped up, from the customs agreements to trade. I mean, you have a trade agreement right now by being a member of the EU with a group of countries that are the same size as the entire United States. And you're basically going to cut off your nose to spite your face and just say, no, we're going to go it alone and cut all these new deals over the next 10 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, you've got people that aren't sure what's going to happen. I mean, will British-made aircraft be allowed to fly and land in the rest of the European Union after the 29th of March next year? That's a real situation.
Wow.
You've got issues over food. And, you know, so much food comes across the channel from the rest of Europe into the United Kingdom. And what sort of inspections are going to be accepted by the EU from the UK for UK produce and fresh fruit and veg and meat going across? And what's going to be acceptable here? All that's up in the air. The scientific and academic communities are struggling because they don't know what's going to happen with all of the things that they're trying to accomplish in terms of getting grants. A lot of these grants are EU grants. The farmers have got EU grants for, you know, basic agricultural that help them to, you know, sustain their businesses. And most of the farmers voted for Brexit.
Wow.
You know, it's like people in the South voting against their own best interests.
Which they tend to do. They do it again and again and again. Look, Mississippi last night just elected Hyde Smith, who's in a vow. Yeah. She's a racist. She's a bigot. It confirmed all the ugly stereotypes about Mississippi. They just owned it.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. But I mean, we've got a situation now where basically this thing's going to come up for a vote, and it doesn't look like it's going to pass at this point. You know, we've had a number of people still leaving the cabinet, and May has basically said, look, you either back my Brexit or we go back to square one. So, and Europe has pretty much said the same thing. So there's basically a gun pointed to the head of the country and to Theresa May saying, you know, it has to be this way or there's going to be no deal. And everybody is terrified about what a no deal Brexit would look
like. Yeah, I'll bet. So when is the deadline that this is supposed to be in place by?
Well, you're going to see all next week there are going to be debates and discussions about this. I mean, even Donald Trump joined criticism of Theresa May's Brexit plan this week.
Of course.
Week. I
mean, did he say something along the lines of, I told her how to do it, but she didn't listen to me?
Yeah. He was claiming it might not allow the UK to trade with the US, this new deal. And a Downing Street spokesperson insisted it was clear we have an independent trade policy under the terms of the agreement. But, you know, Donald Trump was being Donald Trump, and we all know what that's all about. And, you know, we've got the Treasury now going to come out and publish an economic analysis, and every economic analysis I have seen so far has said this is going to be a disaster. I mean, if we leave without a deal, one analysis from the Daily Telegraph said that it would mean 150 billion pounds in output will be lost over 15 years.
Oh, my God.
I mean, we've got businesses lining up like Ford and Airbus to say, okay, we tentatively agree with this particular plan that's on the table, but it's still not a situation. I mean, Theresa May's version of Brexit is predicted to lower the losses to 40 billion. So instead of 150 billion, it's 40 billion. We are literally whistling past the graveyard here. And this thing, I mean, we've got people and businesses, nobody can find any warehouse space to rent, particularly that which is cold or frozen, because companies want to stockpile food, medicine.
Wow.
And, you know, we're talking wartime footings in some instances.
Oh my God.
To make certain that over the 90 to 120 days that it takes for this shambolic mess to settle itself, there will at least not be people running out of vital medicines and drugs and things that they need in their lives. I mean, if you didn't laugh, you'd cry at this point.
Yeah, well, welcome to our world over here in the U.S. I mean, that's an everyday occurrence. It's like, what did he do now? And yeah, you have to struggle to laugh because the alternative is, you know, much worse. So what did you think about the midterm elections over here?
I'm very pleased with what's happened on the House side.
Mm-hmm.
Gutted by what has happened on the Senate side. More importantly, the voter suppression and the tactics of the Republicans in these red states.
That's
from
sickening.
Texas on through to Georgia. Mm-hmm. And the fact that there's nothing that anybody can do to stand up to any of this. And I've been covering the Diebold and the DSNS mm-hmm. election machines since 2006 in Arizona.
Uh-huh.
And I know that those machines are highly suspect,
yep.
easily hackable, both
yep.
at the machine level and at the central tabulation. I covered Pima County, Arizona, back in 06, which is when it first popped up. And there's a group down there called Audit AZ, Audit Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And those folks have been working for years now. I mean, we're talking 12 years to try and get transparency into the process against a government that is largely Republican and does wants to do anything it can to maintain power. Not working so well in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, it will, you know, be the end of them, but it is going to take a long, hard fight and lots of people showing up like they did on Tuesday, the election day, because, I mean, it was people power that did an awful lot in states and made that election a lot closer. More importantly, though, what really really intrigued and heartened me was the number of state legislatures and governments that
mm-hmm.
the balance shifted to the Democrats.
Yep.
So when we have the census in 2020, there's a better chance in some of those crazy states. I think there were four of them: Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, and I forget who the fourth one was, where you clearly had like a 53-47 popular vote victory, but yet almost 60% of all the seats went to Republicans
mm-hmm.
because these districts are so badly gerrymandered.
Yeah.
So
it's a real problem over here.
That wouldn't be allowed to happen here or anyplace else.
Hmm. That's interesting. And voting over there. I mean, you mentioned you had very high turnout. Is that usually the case? Are there voter suppression efforts over there like we have here? Or is that an animal unique to the United States?
You know, we call it suppression, but it's not really suppression. I mean, when we all use the same systems, the VAN system that was created by
mm-hmm.
Obama
mm-hmm.
for political parties here, and you can track and you can look at individuals. And when they say suppression, they just really, when they know they've got somebody that's likely to vote for the other side, you know, it's more of a, let's not do anything to encourage them to come out and vote.
uh-huh.
You know, it's not to the lengths that, you know, people's names are scrubbed from lists. They tried in the general election a year or so ago to put in voter ID. That didn't work.
It's amazing. I guess if it doesn't work over here, the rest of the world will try to adopt it anyway. It's a mess. The good thing that happened, though, we saw, you know, the largest voter turnout ever, I believe, in a midterm election. But the thing is, it wasn't, I mean, on the Democratic side, it was this huge surge of new voters. But the Republican side, they also came out in force, which is, you know, I guess the power of Trump.
Well, and that's what they do historically. I mean, you've always got to work twice as hard
as
the Republicans, because they've got a built-in advantage, both statistically and internally. And, you know, when I see these crazy people, you know, out there misbehaving, I always will retweet and say, look, that person's going to vote. Make sure you do, and bring
mm-hmm.
a friend.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. And that's what we've got to do. Hey, Dennis, one last question for you, also on a different subject, but it's all related. Because it seems all over the world, countries are grappling with immigration issues. You know what's going on here at the border. Trump the other day ordered, they tear gassed people, these refugees who were just trying to come to the U.S. to get asylum here, and they tear gassed them. And Trump is trying to do something where, you know, they're kept in Mexico while their asylum case is heard. It's just insane. What's it like over there? How hard is it to get into the U.K. if you want to immigrate there?
Well, I mean, we've had a situation in Calais, which is, you know, right across from Dover, which has been going on for a number of years, where there are a number of people that are desperate to get here. So desperate that in the last couple of weeks, they've started taking to dinghies to try and make their way across the world's busiest shipping channel, which is the channel between France and England. Several have died. Several have been rescued by boat. But it's been a huge situation. There were camps in Calais for a long time. That didn't work out very well. I mean, so they are being denied the ability to come here as well and apply for asylum. And I don't know what the answer is.
I don't either, but something's got to change. Dennis Campbell, find him at ukprogressive.co.uk. That's the magazine. I just realized I had the old thing up here. What's your new Twitter handle?
New Twitter handle is Client Loyalty DC, at Client Loyalty DC. That's me.
DC. Okay, so ignore what I had up on YouTube this whole time. Dennis Campbell, thank you so much.
People are finally finding me.
I'll fix it on the blog where we link to the podcast and your show. Thank you so much, Dennis Campbell. I'm sure we'll talk again soon. Take care.
Always a pleasure.
For me too. Bye-bye. And that's it. See you tomorrow, everyone.